I'm Jane Stroll. I'm from Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary in Berkeley, California. I've completed my first year on the faculty there and taught Reformation history and theology for 11 years previous to that at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. It was Luther Northwestern when I went. And maximal functional unification gave way to merger while I was there. And so the name became Luther Seminary a couple years back. So I myself am originally from the East Coast. I was ordained in the old LCA in the Maryland Synod and served in New England before my graduate education and other things have SEC led me on a slow but sure westward pilgrimage. So it's delightful to be here and to see you on this gorgeous day. I appreciate your, I thought, 90% rain was the prediction, and doesn't look like it to me, and I can imagine people seizing the opportunity to get out while the weather is good. So I'm glad to see you here. The first two sessions, for those of you who haven't been here for those, we talked a little bit about Luther's experience and how that has been seen as defining, not only for his time, but to give evidence of some ongoing sort of spiritual crises and dynamics in the lives of believers. Yesterday we talked about the Lutheran doctrines of sin, both original and otherwise. And today I've entitled it Freedom and Bondage. And what I'd really like to look at, it's a number of things. One piece of it we'll be talking something about the troubled doctrine of what we call sanctification. For those of you who have had sort of a formal Lutheran education, you know, the two doctrines they always talk about is the division between justification and sanctification. And many of the disagreements in Western Christendom, both with the Roman Catholic Church, from which the Protestants originated, and then amongst themselves, were how do you relate, and to put it in, I think, more straightforward terms, what God does to what we do in terms of the accomplishing of God's will in the world and the transformation and salvation of our lives. That conceptually, a strict distinction was made between justification, which was seen as the work of God in Christ, by which the obstacles, the hostility, the alienation, remember we talked original sin, is defined as our inability to fear, love, and trust God rightly, so that it is God who takes the initiative and completes what is necessary to correct, to reform that relationship, so that, as in the words of Calvin, another Protestant reformer, we said one could chart the experience of justification as moving from understanding God as judge to God as Father. Right? That, so that it's the same God who was there, but now we know this God differently and understand that the primary relationship of God to us is God as the source of all bounty, as the one who love creates and redeems us, so that it eradicates the sense of fear, of obligation on our part to please this one who is looking to find fault, right? The sort of misconceptions before, and the reformers argued that although a result of this is our ability to live transformed lives, never does our reformation or repentance become the cause of God's loving and forgiving us. Rather, one must always keep these things separate and say, it is because God has done those things and sustains that posture towards us through good and ill that we are empowered with the hope both to repent of what is wrong, to persevere when we cannot make things right, and to rejoice indeed when we see a growth in holiness and joy in our lives. Right? And so what often happened at the time of the Reformation, and you'll probably still hear it, is that Lutherans, you're good on this faith stuff, but what about love? The we say justified by grace through faith. I mean, justification by faith is sort of our little tagline. And if one wanted to look at what had been the late medieval Catholic Church's sort of dictum, and probably still is, it's faith formed by love. Okay. and sort of, now it's fine if you people repent, but what about the lives you live? What about your discipleship? And Luther was continually stymied by the way his critics seemed to think that he didn't care very much about the quality of life of his believing community. Luther himself said that it was quite clear that the German pigs that he lived among behaved better under the Pope than they did under the evangelical faith. And he said, but because fear goes a long way to keeping people in line. He was hopeful that as they became accustomed to the experience of freedom under the gospel, they'd sort of get a grip on themselves. In some cases, his confidence was proved warranted, but in many it was not. And that will explain some of the bitterness of his later years. But for all that, he refused ever to sort of backtrack. I find him a great help sometimes when I am dealing with a contentious four-year-old to say, you know, a good threat right now would probably get me where I want to be real quick. But I'm not sure that long-term it's going to be worth it. Right? And I mean, in some sense, sometimes it is. I mean, you pick your battles. But the big one, as Luther said, if you want people to behave the way you want them to behave, the temptation to hold over their heads the judgment of God and God's ferocious wrath in such a way that you really, you know, he said, it's tempting and it may get you immediate results, but long term, you've created a very bad situation for yourself in terms of their being able indeed to know the fullness of God's grace and to understand what it is to love. He said, people who act out of fear simply don't know what it is to love. So that just can't be the motivation. Right, so when I talk about freedom and bondage, let me say one of the most famous treatises of Luther, one I've recommended to you as a good read, not too long, and a classic written in, he had a whole series of them written in 1520. This one is entitled, to translation, either The Freedom of a Christian or On the Freedom of a Christian. And in it, very early on, Luther introduces one of his most famous paradoxes. Now the Lutheran teaching is noted for its paradoxes, and one of the other reformers of the period, Erasmus, once commented that he would rather live with the Pope than burn for one of Luther's paradoxes. They are sometimes quite hard for people to make sense of. In this one, Luther says, indeed, that the Christian is Lord of all, perfectly free, the Lord of all, and perfectly bound, the slave or servant of all. That both of these things are simultaneously and wholly true. Right? It's not that you start as one and move to the other, but you are always both. And then he goes on in this treatise to explain how that can be and why, indeed, for him, the lordship is what makes the servanthood or the slavery possible. And his argument about lordship is to say, because the thing that is most precious and most needful in our lives is our connection with the God who has created us. Because this is certain, guaranteed through the gifts of the promise in Christ Jesus of God's mercy, of God's forgiveness, of God's presence, that nothing needs to be done except to grasp this promise. And let me say that one of the great mistakes that has often happened in our tradition is that faith is described in some ways that all the other works don't matter if you just get this one. As one of my students once commented, I'd rather have a list of several hundred works and know that probably I'd come out okay if I was somewhere in the range of 60 to 80% than have the list reduced to one and not be able to pull it off. And as most of us know, faith is not something that you can coerce. You can't say, I'm just going to have a faithful day today if it kills me, you know? I mean, that's not the way it is. And so as an image to think about what this means, one of the points to me is that Luther looks at the person like himself who was anxious for a clear word from God, and in some sense, I mean, the kind of word that says life is worth going on for, and when it's there, he said, it's not like you debate it, it's like the person drowning in the sea. I mean, if you throw something out for them, they grab it. Or those of you who have been responsible for feeding infants will know that there's sort of this instinctual thing I remember one time I was driving with my daughter when she was very young, and you know, but I think probably parents of young children should be allowed on the road, because they're in a little bucket, you know, in the seat. You're holding the bottle in and driving with one arm, and suddenly something came up, and I needed two hands on the wheel, and I let go of the bottle, and I thought, oh God, it's going to be all over the rug, it'll smell for months, and you know what? And when I let go, the little hands went and just kept right on eating peacefully. And it struck me is that, I mean, once the, I mean, it's sort of developing the capacity, and then it just kicks in. I mean, you know, Luther's trying to say, well, when somebody offers you something good, or what do you do? Well, I mean, faith is that kind of thing. It is a capacity created in us by God. It must not be interpreted as the one work we need to get right. So he's saying that because God makes this abundance available to us, this certainty, that in some sense, all that the world has to offer simply cannot undermine or rob us of the thing that is most important, that is most needful. And in that sense, he argues for all the setbacks and the traumas and the tragedies of our lives. There is nothing that comes to us that will not be obliged under the lordship of Christ to serve our good in the end, as Luther says, even our death. And in that sense, his lordship, his vision of lordship is spelled out, it seems to me, in many ways, like what Paul says in Romans 8. You know, when he lists all those things and then concludes, if God before us, who can be against us? Right? That it is not to say that because we are connected to Christ, we're going to triumph. You know, that our lives are going to be better, kind of a gospel of success. Or the very tragic thing is, you probably all know some people whose lives are visited by so many horrific events that it seems quite reasonable for them to ask after a while, is somebody out there trying to get me? And that one doesn't read the favor of God from these external circumstances, but always reads it in the cross of Christ and the promise that this is for you, whatever the circumstances may be, and those circumstances simply cannot have the last word. Now, Luther would never suggest that it is easy to, to hold these reins of lordship, to believe this, to trust in it. But as Luther said, it is a way of fulfilling the most important of the commandments, the first one, that I am the Lord your God, and you shall have no other gods before me. As Luther says, when you hold the promise of God and you cling to it, even to the point of throwing it in God's face, when you feel like God is not holding up God's end of the deal, in Luther's view, you have fulfilled the first commandment, as he puts it, because you let God be God. You state indeed that you believe this one to be trustworthy and true, so much so that you're going to hold God to God's promise. So that's sort of the realm of lordship as he describes it. I mean, and I think what worries is a realm of faith. It's not kind of this sort of just in my spiritual life I rise above all things and I sort of separate myself from the muck of the world. It's really not that at all. These things have to coexist for him. And then when he talks, I say here, about the freedom, this is where, because here is, of course, a kind of freedom that you simply will not let yourself, in a way, be the victim of these events so that they have the last word. But freedom for Luther is the result of right bondage. I think one of the things, like many important figures, I was just recently reading a book somebody has written on the Declaration of Independence and pointing out that Thomas Jefferson gets more credit than credit is due, but how important a figure like Thomas Jefferson is for this country, how he gets portrayed publicly says something about how we're trying to think about ourselves and how, you know, he becomes a kind of a image that can reflect back what we want to know. And so, for example, current concern about his relationship with Sally Hemings probably says as much about us and what we wrestle with as it does about Thomas Jefferson. Well, Martin Luther is certainly another figure like that, and some interesting studies have been done about this, you know, how have generations after his own life portrayed him. And indeed, in the dawn of the Enlightenment and coming into the modern age of democracy, many people like to grasp onto Luther as this figure who was the first one to stand up against, you know, a whole system, and instead of just accepting what kin and tribe and community demanded of him, he stood and said, here I stand, I can do no other, and I don't agree. And as people have pointed out, what they leave off is the important conclusion to that, where what he says is that he is captive to the word of God. So that he is able to stand against those things because he understands himself to be bound elsewhere. And that becomes a criterion by which he can reject some of the demands of the world upon him. The freedom, then, is from what and for what, as often the question is put, and I think we need to make some distinction between, of course, Luther's own day and our own. For Luther, one of the important, it was the freedom of the gospel, the freedom of the Christian, came from this promise of God to free individuals from the need to secure their own salvation. That he lived, and remember I said that interesting description that was given of Luther's time as a generation of the living in bondage to the dead. That their sense of responsibility, not only for the state of their own souls, so that they could present, I mean, think of a kind of a juridical metaphor, a compelling case before the throne of judgment, as well as for others, that Luther's saying this whole kind of monkey is lifted off the back of individuals, that they must work this out and make this happen, but rather it is God's work in and for them. And in that sense, they are freed from tremendous anxiety, which we see in his own time, and a kind of obsessive compulsive behavior, which would be sort of inescapable under the circumstances. It also, in Luther's view, frees them for the real work of serving God's will in the creation. I used the image yesterday of my friend's little adopted daughter, remember, who had came with crossed eyes when they brought her from the orphanage in Latvia. And that when they first met this child they were adopting, she had no interaction with them, and they were not sure what that portended. And several weeks after she got back to the United States, she had surgery done on her eyes. And within a couple of months, her developmental catch-up was phenomenal. And she called me and said, remember, she said, I suppose you can't really expect a child to relate to her parents in the world when all she can see is the bridge of her nose. That this as an image, as Luther puts it, that this driving concern to secure one's salvation or keep one's slate clean turns people into themselves in such a way that they really are blind to the world around them and to the needs of their neighbor. So his understanding is that if it lifts one burden off your back, it places before you the other appropriate challenge and the purpose of your living. That if one doesn't have to worry about keeping clean and being able to present a good case, what one can do then is seriously engage the world on its own terms. Some of the worst conflicts he had, both with the Roman Catholic tradition, with its councils of perfection, and then also to the left wing, as they put it, of the radical reformers in the Protestant movement, such as the Anabaptists, who tried to form communities with a higher righteousness. And his response to that was, you see, it still ends up that what you worry about is the kind of in-group and keeping it right. And he said, certainly Christians should be able to turn the other cheek and forgive one another, but while they're busy doing that, the wolves will devour the sheep. So that one's obligation is to a world that includes unbelievers, people who have ill intent, as well as people who are very vulnerable, and our calling is to protect them, to stand for them, and to take the risks, indeed, of committing sin, of what would seem to be sin, of having a compromised righteousness. And so that some of the debates he entered into were things like whether a soldier too could be saved, right? Or whether you could have a job as an executioner. And in his usual hyperbolic manner, Luther was of the opinion that if you had the skills and the gifts to be an executioner, then do it, right? That this served a purpose in God's ordering of the world, to protect the weak against malefactors, and that you just, I mean, now what I was saying is, I think there are some parallels here to the kinds of debates we have now around capital punishment, about what we should and shouldn't do and how our righteousness should look. So, but here to say is that there's a way in which Luther sees the work of grace, of justification, of setting right this relationship to God as really freeing one, some sense, for greater engagement with the world. Recognizing, of course, that the deeper you go into the world, the harder it is to know whether you're being righteous. and so that people who are going to build their confidence and their self-image on a kind of, effective morality are going to find that very threatening. I mean, but in some ways you sort of set up, and that's what he saw about some of these communities. You see, they set boundaries within which they could uphold this, but in doing so, we're forgetting about those who were outside, who frankly were, in his opinion, their first obligation. Now, what's interesting is, of course, their response was easy to say, but the fact is that the more you deal with the world, the more you become like it, and you find ways to justify it. You know, it's a slippery slope. And pretty soon, you're not making any kind of Christian witness at all. Every time I come back to those arguments each year when I teach at the seminary, I think we're still right there. We're still, I mean, that really is a dilemma. How to be in the world, but not of it, as Jesus himself put it. So, for Luther, then, the freedom is indeed for service. In this treatise on the freedom of a Christian, he has a very beautiful sort of reflection on the kenosis hymn from Philippians about Christ emptying himself for others, and what it will mean then for the Christian to be a little Christ to another and empty him or herself, even to the point, Luther puts it, of placing at risk, so to speak, the greatest thing of value you have, which is your very justification before God, your very faith in Christ, that too, in some sense, is so secure in the promise of Christ that you can risk putting that on the table for the neighbor. Now, I think the question for us is, would we say the freedom from and for is the same in our time? A number of contemporary theologians, or theologians of this century, foremost among them someone like Paul Tillich, has pointed out that probably the great existential dilemma of our age is not Luther's. Luther never really questioned whether there was a God. Luther questioned whether this God could be trusted to be gracious, or whether in some sense the gospel was just one more mean-spirited way to call us to judgment. The question now, often before us, is, aren't people really far more troubled by whether there's any God at all? And frankly, if they can bring themselves to the point of believing there is, they generally have no trouble thinking that that being or power is benevolent. You know, they don't have to make a heart, I mean, most people don't make the effort to talk themselves into believing into a wrathful God. Now, on the other hand, I think we need to be careful about, I mean, I think that's one part, indeed, of the world around us, or the communities in which we live, but I am struck again and again of how many people that we might think are a little more too sophisticated or mature or whatever are really quite haunted by the possibilities of wrath and judgment. And tend to express this in theological terms. Really came home to me. I was visiting my hometown some weeks ago, and I have a very dear friend I've known since we were 3 years old. That's a very long time now. And in her late 30s, she had the first of a number of psychiatric breakdowns, has been diagnosed as bipolar. And those of you who, something of this, it was called manic depressive. It is, many therapists will tell you, the cruelest of these diseases in some way. It's very difficult to treat for several reasons. And one of them oftentimes is that when they begin to feel better, they just go off their medication. And another friend I know who's worked with it, she said, you know, you find if you get the right medication for somebody who's suffering from depression, it's working for them. They don't really have any interest in letting that go. I mean, this is just better for them. But with manic depression, what often happens is that the exaltation of the manic stage is as alluring, I think we could say, as for people who have substance abuse problems. And why it's hard to let, what you're doing is saying, to make you well, I'm going to bring you back into endless gray. And so it's just, even once it's diagnosed, you just don't know how the term of it, it repeats itself. You seem to get everything back on track. The family's gone through another one. They straighten out the finances. You're back at work. And then it hits again. And the bottom falls out. And is this going to go on and on? And she had clearly come out of an episode and was back functioning somewhat. But you could see terribly anxious about things. And finally, I said, well, what do you worry about? Well, we went through some things about, you know, our bank book didn't balance. And I said, well, these things can be worked out, you know. So that, but I mean, you can figure. And then finally, at one point, just turned and looked at me, and she said, "Well, I'm afraid I'm going to die and go to hell." And I said, "Well, now, pretty dark. Well, why? Well, I mean, it's sort of manic depression isn't. This is not terminal. But I said, why would you think that?" She said, "Because I've made my mother suffer so." And I found myself saying, you made your mother suffer. I mean, sweetheart, you know, you're doing a short course in the passion play here. And I mean, let's talk about who's suffering. But I realized this wasn't there. And of course, you put it all together. I mean, what it was is that her mother's in her 80s. And what this is doing to her. Her father died tragically in an accident not long after the first episode, and they never sorted it out because her parents grew up in a generation where this was shameful. It was shameful, and they don't really, this is one of these sort of, how do you put all that together? How do you talk about, right? So that I think the sense of a feeling of wrath, of judgment, of something coming down upon her, we don't want to be too quick to dismiss that. Because in other times, let me tell you, she probably would have sounded a lot like as some of those people who, well, you know, I'm not so sure what I think about that there's a God or anything. I don't know that we will always find people expressing it in the kinds of classic religious terms, kind of Luther's age, but I am often struck by it. A kind of a sense of and people of whatever is out there, it appears to be malevolent. You know. Another piece that we can't, I mean, I don't think has changed a great deal is that the world around us is still desperately in need of our undivided attention, of our ability to engage it, not to run from it, and to risk its muck, you know, I gave an example of my nephew yesterday, and I'll give another one, I'll never forget this. My nephew grew up in Chicago when he was a little boy. He was in Hyde Park area, so he was a kind of a city kid, and very careful about, you know, where he was supposed to go, and people knew where he was. And I took him back with me to visit my parents in Maryland one summer, and Grandpa went out to work in the yard, so. And if he put on his little baseball cap, he's going to go out and help him. And he walks out the back door, goes down the steps, gets on the sidewalk, and he walks on the sidewalk, and he walks all the way around to the front door, and then he walks all the way back again. And that was being outside. And my father said, you can go off the sidewalk. And he said, oh, no, Grandpa, I might step in some dog poop. And I've always thought of that as sort of, well, yes, you can stay on the straight and narrow. Right, because, and you know, it's got clear boundaries and it's kept clean and you don't have any, I mean, it won't worry about, but it, you, it's hard to stay there a whole lifetime. It gets boring, you know. But to step out into the fullness of the world is to risk dog poop. I mean, that's...
Can we quote you on that?
Yes, of course. And that, but... part of it is that is the least of our problems. I mean, I was just saying, that's the least of our problems. The problems that the world has just call for that kind of willingness to exercise the freedom, to risk disagreement, to risk being wrong, right, and the courage to persevere. And most of all, to tell the truth about what we find, what we know, and what we don't know. So I think in that way, it is an extraordinary kind of, you know, warrant for discipleship. But as we mentioned yesterday, that kind of freedom is very burdensome and very frightening. And it is that place where Luther talks about this lordship, in some sense, kind of representing a bottom below which you won't drop, you know, in terms of knowing who you are and what you're about. That in the midst of all the unclarity and what at some points is just plain darkness, there is this that is light, that is clear, that is certain. I'd like to say a few things about the complexity of discipleship and then shut up and give you a chance to join in. This issue about being justified as when it comes to the question of works, and I think especially with young people, I find very often that when you're still at the stage of your life, you really do have kind of a different ardor and a hopefulness. It's a little sad, isn't it, how you find to have somebody young around you that you realize that you have kind of compromised on a number of things. I mean, just, well, but that's just not the way the world is, Henry, you know, and, well, it's the way it should be, you know, that are really concerned about what they see is sometimes a lack of ferocious and energetic social commitment on the part of our church, and it's been faulted for. And Luther himself, as I say, was always mystified why people thought that Lutherans didn't care about that. The issue for him was not that it was unimportant, but putting it in its right place. I mean, you could look at all the various parts of Christendom in those days, say they all had kind of the same rest, you know, they had the same ingredients on the table, but they put them in different places in the configuration of how God works and how we are involved in God's plan. And so when it comes to this issue of justification, I mean, it's one way to say we cannot justify ourselves before God, and it's simply not expected, but we damn well better be justified before our neighbors. I mean, in that sense, we are accountable before our neighbors. That's not going to save us before God, but to recognize that their demands, the issues of justice, the fact that it has been made clear to us that we have responsibilities for those who are weakest and most vulnerable among us. And I don't want to make, I mean, then you can get done with a recipe like that and feel like saying, my gosh, some days I can hardly get three meals on the table and get the children out to school, you know, and get to work, and meanwhile, half of the world is going to hell in a handbasket. I think this is one thing I'll talk about tomorrow. This does not come upon everyone, individually, you need to save the world, or something. We're talking about how we work as a community and share efforts, but keep a vision going about where we are needed and what we can do. So that Luther is very clear about the demands of us, of our neighbors, and our accountability in our use of our resources and of the gifts we are given. As he said, in matters of salvation, reason is a whore, in another rather colorful description, that human reason cannot sort this out and bring one to Christ, but it is a good gift in the realm of things that are within human charge. So that all that we know and all that we are able to discover, I mean, and that's why we're faced with hard choices like something about cloning. I mean, this is, our discoveries there are a sign of both the kind of curiosity, perseverance, wish to help, I mean, that are part of what we're created to be, the judgments about how to use the powers and the knowledge that we have are indeed things, I mean, one of the biggest tasks before us. And as Luther said, that's the stuff of discipleship, the very stuff of discipleship. I have often told my students that I think we are generally pretty works righteous in our approach. And I want to say that that has its good points. It certainly contributes to civility. I think that one of the things we have to recognize is that when things are going pretty well in our lives, that is sort of the way we measure it. You know, I'm honoring my obligations here, and I'm taking care of this, and that there is this satisfaction that the power of the gospel, as Luther, the Lutheran Confessions presented, is seen and experienced most sharply when the bottom falls out. And we've all had experiences like that. When, as Luther said, the piety of his day used to suggest, look, don't obsess about this. Do what you can do. Do the best that is in you was the thing, and then God will meet it with grace. It was, as they put it, very reasonable piety. And the truth is, sometimes that's exactly the pastoral advice we need to give to others and to ourselves. We say, you know, you can only do the best you can do. You're in trouble. But we come to these times in our lives where, you know, what would seem like reasonable advice is at best a counsel of despair if it's not just plain irrelevant. You know, where suddenly it's just illness. Something, a family breaks apart in a way you didn't expect. A child comes into the world with a birth defect that you know, and suddenly all that you had planned and expected isn't going to be. And there's nothing really you can do about it. And you're sort of thrown back to asking the most basic of questions. And I think that, of course, the compulsion to do, I mean, that's what makes us. We were laughing this morning, Mary and I were sharing a chalet and saying that one of the best things for housekeeping is a bad encounter with a child, because you just think, I'm going to go do something else. I had a squabble with my daughter. Finally, I'll clean the hairbrushes. You know, that you know you're going to do. And you come upon these situations where there is nothing to be done. And I come back to this example of this friend of mine with this, I mean, really horrible disorder, you know. I mean, it's sort of, and I sit there and I think, this person I have known, she periodically can just disappear. And she can sometimes feel it coming, she can't stop it, you know, and all of us who stand around her and love her can't do anything. And I can't even talk her out of thinking that she'll be damned because she's made us all suffer. You know, and that she knows enough to know it's true, to see it. And I think it's at moments like that that you stop and say, well, where do I turn now? How do I make any sense of it? What indeed does she draw on? And your first inclination is to say, oh, well, no, if you call the bank, they can send you copies of all those bank statements, and you can reconcile them and see what happened to the money. And I started that, and that's when, I mean, it was sort of like, oh, Jane, can it? When she could turn and say, well, what I'm really afraid of is that we're going to die and go to hell. Well, oh, well, gosh, you can't really, I don't know who you call about that. How we reconcile those accounts, you know. And knowing, and then to look at me at one point and say, I don't know whether I can stand this much longer. I really want to die. And I had a moment when I said that for the first time, I thought, I said, I can understand that. And it was a crushing, it's feeling like a great betrayal. You're supposed to come up with, well, saying, because whatever comes of this, the answer could say, you know, you are in the hands of one who loves you. I said, I know at the moment you can't believe that. I mean, you're just having enough trouble getting through a day. And I will believe that for you. And so I think here is the place where Luther talks about, that's where this lordship matters. That even this disease that robs her of herself at times and does indeed cause her family to suffer greatly. And lets even somebody like me think, well, you know, I had 4 days of weeping for it, but then I flew back to the other coast. And, no one can move into it for her. That this is the place where to talk about even this will not have the last word of who she is and what her life is to be. And what has struck me is how, in the midst of it, she does find ways to draw on a sort of grace to continue. But that, I would say, this is an extreme case, let me say, but I think all of us can say that is the way our discipleship is experienced. It is very bleak and dark at times. It seems quite empty and pointless. And that, Luther said, is that suddenly what it is, I mean, I spoke yesterday about being marked with the cross of Christ when we are baptized. That said, we can look at that in comfort. We can say sometimes, indeed, it comes upon us as reproach. I also add for Luther, it is for him a sort of a claim on God as well. Remember me? Right? Remember whose I am? To make claim that nothing will come between me and the love of God in Christ Jesus my Lord. And this is my seal and guarantee. So that how one plays, I talked yesterday a little bit about if you're dealing with a paradox, and as one teacher I heard said, what you do is you have a problem, and you can draw like the sign for infinity. And he said, you have to look at things like this and say, it's not that you resolve the tension, you learn to manage it. That there's a way, it seems to me, that that's what you want to say about discipleship, about what Luther talks about lordship and servanthood. That it is always managing that tension to know oneself as both of these and to honor both of those callings as to who we are. Let me stop there for questions or comments.
You said justification and sanctification. Could you just kind of re-summarize those two?
Justification is seen as the act by which God reconciles us to God. That here in the work of Christ, in the cross, is made manifest to us God's love for us and desire to breach what alienates or separates us. So that what the Protestant tradition has argued is this grace, interpreted as the favor of God, is grasped in faith. And that what the tricky piece there, as I say, is it's very easy to turn faith into an accomplishment, a work. I mean, that it is not... I remember one time my brother was going through a difficult period, and he had talked to one of his professors at the seminary, and he said, well, I'm going to go back and read so-and-so on that. And he told me, the professor put his hand on his arm and said, I think you'll find it interesting reading, Ralph, but let me assure you, salvation does not lie in the next book you read. That it wasn't simply a matter of getting the content right or getting your doctorate, but that this is really a relational thing of what it is to even, I mean, somebody said, well, what would you give as a Lutheran example of disciples? And I think my two favorite, first is there are three, one I'm going to talk about later, but from the Bible, if you take the man whose son had the demon, remember, and the disciples are trying to, woo! And they don't do too well on their first outing. And and how does the man respond when Jesus turns and then he says, Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief. Which is really sort of the posture of what it is, both to hold and to fear, in some sense, won't that be true, Peter, as another example, whose faith was strong enough that he could recover from denial. What he could believe was that the graciousness and forgiveness were strong enough to make good that, to embrace that. And he had the courage, you see, to grasp it as for him. And then one other I'll talk about later is the Canaanite woman, who for Luther is the classic example of the person who says, "Yea, Lord, but even the dogs eat the crumbs from under their master's table." Right, where Jesus says, "Great is your faith." So that's what we do. The appearances can be quite deceptive, but you hold God to being God as the one who will love and forgive. But the work there is God's in Christ. And what comes from this in Luther's Protestant argument is a new orientation that, in some sense, releases powers, the gift of the Spirit, for service in the world, so that sanctification is seen indeed as really the formation of the disciple, the witness of the life lived. Now, where we have came into conflict, or Luther came into conflict with the church that raised him, was over the argument that they would sort of combine the two. When they talk about faith formed by love, that what rectifies the situation with God and brings one into communion with God is both the action of God's grace and the human response to it of obedient love. And what I want to make clear is obedient love is as essential in this vision, but in the Lutheran vision, it's just that it is not seen as justifying. Okay? But it does allow, I mean, for this expectation that indeed it makes a difference in who we are and what we aspire to be and how we grow. And yet, simultaneously, we remain broken persons, not perfect saints. Does that kind of, yeah?
One of the problems is the temptation to read it backwards then. That is, when you look at the righteous life, and, you know, we go through these things all the time, at least in our own life. I do in my life, and, you know, with people who ask about what these things mean. And the temptation is to read one's life, you know, your life is a book, and do people see Jesus? Okay, so to read your life and this perfectionism thing, God forbid they see the darkness or the vulnerability or my brokenness. They read my life and see the righteousness. Mm-hmm. The implication is then that you are a member of the elect, or you are a member of the saved. And so what happens is that then faith becomes that kind of work wherein, well, you know, do what you say. If it's really true, then act like it. You know, like act your age, act your faith, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's a real difficult thing in the life of a community, because you have people in one part of the community who are very good readers. They're walking around reading everybody's life and second guessing whether they're members of the elect. And then you got people who are more honest about it and say, yeah, you really can't do that. You know, I mean, and then they say back to you, well, then what does it mean? I mean, if you can just do what you want, and you're kind of a moral slob, and you're rough around the edges, then what's the point? Yes. See, what does salvation mean in the moral and the ethics of daily life? And of course, this gets to issues that are really difficult for us sometimes. And in communities around homosexuality or abortion or a lot of issues like this. You know, you refer to capital punishment. But
or even things like people living together. Is that an appropriate person to have leading your youth group?
Right.
You know, as a couple.
Right. Or baptizing a baby, mm-hmm. and 30 people come in from 6 states and no one's part of the community.
Yeah.
And what do you do with that? I mean, do you have any courage to say anything about that? Or, you know, do you appeal to the kind of the vertical sacramental thing of, you know, you do it because you just turn it all over? And I mean, those are real issues.
Yes.
And I think that in life of community, then people are kind of policing that, you know. They police that and say, well, you know, according to what I read in this life, the referent is not the elect. The referent is not the saved. And I think I think you really get in a lot of difficulty with that thing of justification, sanctification. What does a sanctified life look like?
Right, and I think, Randy, you point there. I mean, that is, I've often looked at, you know, that there's one to me, it's a classic one. That is a tension we have to learn to live with. That is not one that can be resolved. That in some sense, the witness comes to us. Yes, I mean, of course your life should give some witness. You know, I mean, to the right, it'd be that you would be forgiving, that you would be all, I mean, that a number of things, that the moral imperatives of it, I don't want to make light of it. Indeed, one of the dilemmas you pointed out, if you look at many writers in Christian theologians now are saying one of the things we really have to concern ourselves about in our contemporary society is that we raise not only children, but all members, I mean, coming into our church with a clear sense of the narrative of who they are. And that gets acted out, imprinted in kinds of behaviors. Just like, I mean, how many of you are at that thing, you know, you go say, well, I know we eat on the sofa in our house, but these people do not eat on the sofa. Right? I mean, in our community, we don't do that. Right? And you need to understand that's part of what our community is, and it's saying something about that behavior elsewhere. The other side of it, of course, is how many people get driven away because what they see actually is usually a somewhat circumscribed list of moral imperatives. I mean, it's a little bit like my nephew's sidewalk. If you keep it narrow enough, you can keep it clean and you can stick to it. And it doesn't get as messy. And then they're saying, well, that's fine. I'm glad you all go crazy every time somebody has some kind of sexual encounter you think they shouldn't have. And yet at the same time, you don't say anything about rampant greed and misuse. This seems to me rather a selective way of sorting out who's righteous and who's not. There, the other places, how do we give the kind of witness that speaks to the no's, the choices we make in our lives precisely because it matters to us that we are part of this community and that we measure it against what we see as the vision of the fullness of the stature of Christ and give the witness of what it is to recognize our need for the grace of forgiveness, to be bold to ask for it, to accept it and grant it in turn. And somehow both of those things have to be there. And I think that that's really a big part of the balancing act.
Are you saying too, though, that the sanctification and legalism sometimes in our perspective of it go sort of hand in hand in certain parts of society? You talked about the narrowness of the sidewalk. I see that metaphorically as being, well, the more legalistic you are, the narrower the sidewalk right. becomes. And we've all seen certain parts of our Christian community, not necessarily Lutherans, but sometimes necessarily Lutherans, that have this rather legalistic outlook on sanctification and what it is and what it embodies. But I think that what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that Luther says no, that sanctification is not legalism. In fact, it's freedom. Yeah. And that seems to be the paradox.
Well, yes. And let me say, Luther himself felt, I mean, in his later years, he marched out of Wittenberg and wasn't going to go back there anymore. And among the things he listed that bothered him was that the young women were showing too much bosom. This seems to me sort of straining at gnats in terms of the coming of the kingdom of God. But, I mean, I think that, and there is the point, I mean, we want to have freedom. It's important to talk about it. Yes, it's freedom. You don't want to fall into a moralism and legalism. And the other side is people are looking for some particular answers, you know? And so what I struggle with is how behaviors and disciplines, I mean, they strike me as the why we can't define our holiness on their basis is because they're malleable and different communities of people embrace different ones and use them in different ways. And so they can indeed serve well the proclamation of grace and the formation of a sense of ourselves as Christians open to others. But you couldn't say this is the standard 10 that always work, right? And I think that's the place we often come against conflicts, or that what happens is, I mean, I think probably a good example for so many people in our church is divorce, is that tons and tons of people grew up with a sense that just wasn't appropriate, that wasn't desirable. And then it happens to them, right? And in some ways, it's not that they say, well, no, actually, I think it's a great invention. Everybody should try it. I mean, that's not at all what they're saying or reacting to, but they clearly have to make some adjustment in this definition of what holds them, puts them inside the community as one that can be a viable witness. You know what I mean? And that, it seems to me, is how our life's experience draws us sort of forward and deeper often into rethinking at many stages of our lives. What are the things that become, I think of Michael's sermon last night, what suddenly is a weight-bearing wall, and what proves to be more decorative, or frankly didn't bear the weight. You see, and I hope that could be a way of saying, oh, it doesn't matter what you do, because heavens, of course it matters what you do. I mean, people are always looking to us, or we to others. In fact, we were talking this morning about how hard it is to sort of come into your womanhood in this era, because a lot of us, I bet our moms grew up, prepared us for a world that disappeared right about the time we graduated from home ec. And that sense that you would have somebody beyond that you would look to help you chart that path. So, and some specifics, you know, about what it is. But I think that's the place where it is an arena of freedom and creativity. And that doesn't mean there aren't some bedrocks that hold, but I just find, I found it much easier to be a disciple when I was 22 because I knew quite well and certainly what everybody else should be doing, yeah. In the world at large. And what I say is sad about it now is because I've appreciated the complexity of the world. Now, sometimes I think I let myself and the world off the hook a little too easily. And that's where we need this. So, let me just do it here and then here and then there. Now I'm set up for a while. Striped shirt, flowered shirt, T-shirt.
I had a question, but I'm going to pass right for the moment.
You sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll come back. Okay. You want? Okay. Please, go ahead.
I just think I know lots of people who have definite guidelines about why they're sanctified, and I think that sometimes we do that because we're terrified of the things we don't know about. So we pick the ones we think we can control, and then make it our obvious thing that turns out to people. But in reality, it's only because we don't know what else we can defend or what else we can really live up to.
And you point there to one of the things I think the Lutheran vision is quite clear of, is that a desperate need for control, that one of the things actually that makes this doctrine of justification distasteful to people is because they really don't have any control over it at all. And then it becomes all the more likely to think, I can, have some control here. Yeah. Please, over here.
Well, I'm struggling with thinking about these things in terms of holiness code versus compassion. I mean, that seems to be a split in a way that you can look at the gospel. Be holy as your Father is in heaven is holy, or be compassionate as your Father is compassionate. It seems like most of this session has been talking about holiness code and not about compassion.
I'm sorry it occurred that way, because I didn't mean it to be, but I think you point there exactly, is that we, in some sense, we need both. that and indeed Lutheran teaching about the law has never argued that it is abolished. And that in some sense its place in terms of ordering a common life so that humans can live with one another humanely. But I do think you get at then is the place where you begin to take those kind of prescriptions into what makes possible one's relationship with God or holds one in it. So the kind of thing is people who do that don't belong here. Or as I once heard somebody say in a Christian institution in the old days when people did something distasteful, they had the good sense to go away. You know what I thought?
That's right.
Right after Golgotha, right? I mean, what? I just thought, do you not, I mean, my heavens, this is not the, you know, and I think that is the
That's
Sabbath.
That's not the old days.
But Michael was saying you tear down the weight-bearing walls, too.
Yes.
I'm
or that you reorganize. Well, and I think that here is the point in tearing them down, in recognizing that, here's the point to me, all of us are going to have some structures that are useful, that are fruitful in terms of our own sense of growth in Christian tradition. I think this happens in communities, in the way they worship. Remember, if you look at the confessions, when they talk about practices and traditions, which I think is the large realm of this, one of the distinctions they make is they will not use the descriptive adjective of holy. It is not divine or holy tradition. They very carefully want to describe it as human. And that is not meant to dismiss it as second rate, but to point out that this is the necessary response to the word of grace that we hear to shape a discipleship that's effective, that's powerful, that's constant. But there isn't going to be one fixed way to do it. And so that willingness, I mean, I think to re-examine what will bear the weight, for whom do we need to be careful in how we decide to go about this. It's only to say that that's why to me it is such a realm of freedom, because there's kind of, Michael used this thing about sort of raising buildings, and I always like to think too about cleaning closets. Right? That thing about that finally got, and you pull everything out and you just have to say to yourself, I'm never going to fit into that dress again. Never. And it's time to let go of it. Right? It's time, I mean, or these things need, something else needs to be brought in that I don't have. One of my friends said, when you move to California, you're going to find you need a whole different wardrobe. And that has in some ways, I thought, I haven't needed it just to get to work decently clothed. I've needed a different wardrobe in a lot of different ways for the work that I'm doing. And so I think that's the way I do it. What happens, I think, is so often they calcify. See, I mean, that, and or that the conclusion is, if it worked for me, it's got to work forever. Sort of, or for it to be valid, it has to be validated as eternally true. Do you know what I mean? And there's the place that I think. And think about just in congregations. You know, I told people yesterday in worship, in the congregation I grew up in, it was originally a union congregation with a Reformed church. So when I was a child, we celebrated communion four times a year. Then it moved up to once a month, and now they're working towards weekly communion. And one time when I was home and I was ill, my mother said she'd stay home with me on Sunday. And I said, well, Mom, it's the Christmas season. You should go. They'll sing carols. And she looked at me and said, oh, well, they celebrate communion every Sunday during Advent, and I'm just all communioned out. And I thought, well, apparently they didn't explain this very well as to why they were doing this. OD'd on Jesus. You know? Ready? What an obit that will make. But what I realized was here was a sense where my mother needed some help in not thinking that what had worked and was that there was something defective, but there was another way it could be done. And for the whole of the community, moving to doing it that way made sense now. See, that's the kind of thing I mean. Yes, please.
Now, what he was talking about, holiness being set apart from compassion, holiness, that sanctification process, I think of as being set apart for what God intends for us. And when you think about the sidewalk and the yard situation, so often I see everybody playing in the yard and afraid to be on the sidewalk with any kind of spiritual discipline because they're afraid that they're going to fall into legalism, and so that they're rolling in the stuff in the yard and doing whatever. and I think of in Galatians where it says, stand fast in your freedom and don't use freedom for the flesh, but by love serve one another.
To become another kind of bondage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and I think you're so right there. I mean, and this is the thing to say, have not our times changed? At the time of the Reformation and the strong reaction against certain practices that turned to this works righteousness, well, it made sense that we're, but we're in a different place now. So that, and to understand that if we can look at these sort of prescriptions, possibilities, disciplines as a gift so that we might grow, that they don't then become shackles. You know, so that I, for instance, so that, well, once you start keeping a spiritual journal, do that, you better be ready to do it for the next 75 years. Because, well, no, maybe, you know, or my service in this discipline, or that in this period of my life, what my primary vocation is to be a parent, or to be, but there will be other things later, and I will have to make adjustments in that. I think you're, I mean, but what you're presenting it is as an opportunity. I mean, and what I like to say is then those things don't hold apart. You see, they run together. That, I think, is what Luther is anxious. It's not that I have to abandon this to be spiritual and then I go back and get dirty, but that actually I weave my sidewalk through the richness of this world. And remember, I mean, one of the most helpful things I heard at Luther from one of my colleagues, he said, it always worries me when I hear students talk that mission is about bringing Jesus to places he's not. He said, the point is that when you go out into that world, guess who's going to meet you there? Mm-hmm.